can't take this madness any longer. Eye for an eye, bomb for a bomb. How can prayers for peace be answered while the battle rages on? No more, no, no more nightmares. No more, no, no more bomb scares. For the sake of the ones we love, shalom, shalom.
So welcome, welcome, everybody. As we do each week, we start with the song by one of my favorite Jewish groups, not an Israeli, American Jewish group, Safam. You listen to the lyrics, Shalom, Shalom. If ever Shalom was ever needed in that part of the world, it is now. Asaf and I were just talking about what is happening psychologically in Israel. Asaf has family, as many of us do, and you know, well, we could hope and pray for the best and hope that the people of Israel will be able to recover from this trauma. And it certainly is that. One of the things I like about doing this show is I get to talk to some old friends. I mean, I knew Asaf when he was a young boy. I mean, I know his dad. I know his uncle, his cousin. And my son, who are now in their 40s, were childhood friends. So it's wonderful to see Asaf. And Asaf and I actually worked together many years ago. He was the expert then, as he's more so now, on the Middle East at the JCRC. You know, it's probably true that just about every Jew has an opinion about what is happening in Israel, but Asaf actually has the credentials. Asaf has a doctorate in Middle East studies. He is an author, a teacher. He's the head, the executive director of the Association of the Middle East Studies. He studied at Hebrew University and King's College, where he got in London, where he got his doctorate. And so, as I said, Asaf is a real maven, not only somebody who claims to be a maven. So it's wonderful to see you, Asaf. Please give my best to the mishpocha. But one of the things I like to do, Asaf, is to ask my guests just to tell a little bit about themselves. What is it that has called you really to devote so much of your life to studying and advocating on behalf of the state of Israel, really of the Jewish people, and you've continued it. It's probably, I don't know when you started your interest in Israel, but as long as I have known you, and of course your family, I mean, Asaf's grandfather was a very prominent rabbi in Philadelphia, Rabbi Romorowski. But Asaf, tell us a little bit about who you are before we start analyzing what Israel should be doing if they only listen to you.
Oh, Bert, it's good to be here, and it's good to see you, and it's always good to be amongst friends. And that's the nicest part about, you know, being able to come together. You know, my Zionist journey, you know, starts at home. I mean, you know, you mentioned my grandfather, who, you know, I have a picture in my office with him meeting with Golda Meir and David Ben-Gurion and talking about, you know, a different kind of a generation. I think that generation that he was part of was one that, of course, saw the shift between not having a state to having a state and, you know, and beginning to be involved in advocating for a state and understanding the Zionism within the American Jewish community. And, you know, on the other side of my family, on my mother's side, you know, there are Holocaust survivors, grandparents survived, you know, came from Hungary. And my grandmother was a sole survivor of 10 siblings. And so the motivation of, you know, trying to tackle anti-Semitism, tackle understanding Israel within the world, you know, all stems from that. And I've spent the better part of my professional career dealing with these topics, writing about them and trying to, not sure anybody's listening, but, you know, but just at least, you know, give my two cents on the issue of listening and the kind of historiography of things. I mean, As you know, a topic that I've been unpacking for writing about for over 30 years has been the topic of UNRWA. Nobody really cared about UNRWA or knew about UNRWA. And then suddenly October 7th comes around. And not that I wanted to be in a position where I said I told you so, but we've been looking at this, the anomaly of these institutions that have contributed to the problem, the chaos. And so that's where I've seen my role. And on the other hand, I mean, I still believe that many of the problems that going back to our days at the Federation, to HCRC, you know, that the biggest problem that I have observed is apathy and lack of education. And I believe that we need to do a better job on the educational front to tackle these issues. What I'm seeing today is a great deal of propaganda, even more so with the amplified by social media. So these are the kind of things that I spend my days and time, you know, trying to unpack and tackle and add a little bit more of sense or a little bit of sanity to some of this.
Do you feel, yeah, I mean, we all were very, very concerned about, you know, what was going on in college campuses. And in fact, one of my earlier shows, I have a nephew who's a professor at MIT. He talked about, you know, what was happening at MIT, and that they really, I mean, he felt that part of it was that the young people, he felt the majority of Jewish kids there really weren't paying much attention to what was happening in terms of the, you know, the ill-informed criticism of Israel. But he felt that by and large, young Jews, well-educated young Jews, really don't know very much about Israel. I mean, I have, you know, my son Josh, who I know you knew. I mean, Josh grew up in Habonim. Josh describes himself as a left of center Zionist, and people say, "Oh, how can you be?" I mean, and to question if somebody could be somebody a liberal Zionist, and people think that that's an anomaly, is blatant ignorance. And nevertheless, there are well-educated young Jews who don't have that history. I mean, he was raised, I mean, you know, Josh went to Israel when he was in high school. All my children went to Israel, but that was the family they were raised in. I mean, what do you attribute the either ignorance or lack of concern on the part of, again, well-educated young people who either don't care or said things about Israel that you really, mind-boggling in some cases. I mean, what do you attribute it to? I mean, it's not just self-hatred. It's just...
No, it's not. I mean, you know, there are patterns of behavior. I mean, to your point, I mean, I've observed a few things over the years. I mean, one, to your point, you know, people, you know, like yourself, who raise their kids with Zionist anchors, it starts in the home. And so I think that there is one element to that, you know, as far as understanding that there is no contradiction, you know, to paraphrase, you know, Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Brandeis, between being an American and being a Jew, and the fact that Zionism is a part, one can be the two, and there's no contradiction. I think that what you're seeing today, and this is a growing phenomenon, is that Jews kind of have a kind of a double whammy. You know, they are guilt-ridden by Jewish guilt and third world guilt. And that has played into the growing narrative of I'm Jewish, but where there's been an attempt to try to carve out one's Jewishness and trying to parse out the Zionist part of their identity. And the other part of this element, you know, this guilt part that plays into it, you know, we teach our kids to be globalists. We talk about, you know, and so there's been a growing narrative within the Jewish community that somehow the Tikkun Olam narrative has shifted to become a global narrative, and they feel guilty about the Zionist part. The part that really, I think, historically has played into this as well is the fact that there was a great deal of sympathy and love for understanding for the world when Jews were powerless. So up until 1967, you had this kind of, you know, shtetl Jewish mentality of, you know, Israel is an unsafe neighborhood, Israel is being attacked, Israel is a small country. And, you know, post-1967, when you see really Israel exercising power and using power, then you see a growth of criticism of abuse of power. And so that has also been a contributing factor into this narrative. And what I see today, unfortunately, which is an uncomfortable topic to talk about, but when you look at groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voices for Peace, that I would argue are neither Jewish or for peace, you actually have anti-Semitic Jews. It's a phenomenon that is not comfortable to talk about. And, you know, within
but I think it's something we have to talk about, not only in the context of Israel, but in the context of, you know, with the, yeah, I don't like the term the continuity of the Jewish people, because we've been, thank God, we've been around a long time. But I think the health of the Jewish community, really, we ought to take a look at why anybody would feel uncomfortable being a Jew. And I think that it to some degree, it plays in the attitude about Israel, but it plays in a lot of, well, yeah, I'm Jewish, so what? Well, you know, that's
right. And to my mind, it also relates to those historical anchors that I was mentioning before. I mean, the founding fathers of Zionism, you know, left, right, center, religious, secular, whatever they felt about Zionism, they did agree about the fact about the existence of the state of Israel and all its warts and problems and whatnot. The, you know, and so that was the end goal was there. You know, Zionism to me is about renewal. And so the lack of historical anchors that the younger generation has, they don't know 48, 67. Look, even kids, you know, on campus today, they don't remember 9/11. I mean, so, you know, 10/7 comes out of a vacuum for them. And, you know, the immediate response, which, you know, I've been tracking for all these years, you know, has to do with the rise of the boycott movement and other kind of elements, you know, the use of allegations of apartheid, genocide, and things of that nature. But while Zionism as racism was repealed at the United Nations in 1991, that is religiosity on American college campuses. And so there is this narrative that, you know, you are, you know, if you support Zionism, you are a racist. And of course, the debate in American politics about race has been parachuted into the paradigm of the Israeli-Palestinian dynamic. And it's become very simple. You know, Jews are white colonialists. Palestinians are black, and so, of course, Israelis are racist. Israel exported its racism, and that's the narrative that they understand on American college campuses, which is, again, fallacious, myopic, binary, ahistorical, and afactual. And so,
other than that, yeah.
Yeah, other than all of that. I mean, so you're dealing with you're dealing with a need to actually, you know, understand how we got here. I mean, the mere recent history, even how Israel got to Gaza, left Gaza in 2005, is not part of the prism of these kids who are trying to understand that. And so when you found and you saw the encampments on American college campuses, I mean, you know, you're seeing the reaction of colonialism, and not only that, but the mere support for this is not flags of the PLO like it was 20, 30 years ago. These are Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah flags, actual terrorism that is being given a pass in the name of free speech, which is ludicrous and insane to me. And you need to actually understand the nefarious activity that is happening that has taken this into a whole other level. And so Jews of all stripes and colors are not prepared. There's no guarantee if you are a byproduct of a Jewish day school, a public school, you will know how to deal with this environment. Furthermore, I would argue it should not be, you know, you should not be dealing with these issues by the time you get to college campuses. It's too late.
Oh, you're exactly right.
You got to start as young as possible. The same kind of biases that you're seeing today has basically, you know, it trickled down to the K-12 narrative. And that's another thing that needs to be, we need to do a much better job, to my earlier point, about educating the story, warts and all, but they need to know the story. They just don't know the story to even respond to anything.
Do you feel that the Jewish educational establishment, for lack of a better term, whether it's the synagogues or the youth groups, have learned that? I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's one of the reasons, you know, we sent Josh to a Zionist camp. That is one of the reasons my daughters went to Israel when they were young, because I wanted them to experience Israel, you know, for them, themselves, and have good feelings about. And even though, again, I mean, Josh and one of my daughters is certainly not a fan of the government of Israel, but they care deeply about Israel. They read the news about Israel. They have friends and family in Israel. So it's part of who they are. But again, we couldn't make that happen if they weren't in an environment, whether it was youth groups. Do you think that the the day schools, the after school schools are recognizing that they did a lousy job at really teaching about Israel, warts and all? You know, I always say to people, Israel is not a perfect country. Show me three perfect countries, and then Israel could emulate them.
Right. I mean, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think that we've always been behind the eight ball, and I think that we have not done a good job about it. As an historian and, you know, someone who's been teaching and writing about these topics, I mean, the problem that I've observed for years is that up until 1945, it's historical. From 45 on, it becomes current events. You cannot teach, you know, the history of Israel as a feature of current events. I mean, we have to know the story. And I think that there's not enough being done on Holocaust education. And you and I have dealt with that, you know, 30 years ago. And, you know, it's still a problem today. And you're talking also about the fact that they need to understand the story. There is a feeling of Jews, you know, who teach in a lot of these institutions, feel uncomfortable talking about the topic. I said, why do you feel uncomfortable? Just teach the history. If you know that, if you present, I mean, I was trained, you know, to actually look at the primary documents, look at the Arabic, look at the Hebrew, look at the
English. You read Arabic, yes.
And you read, yes, I do. And you deal with all of these topics, and you want to look at the primary documents. And if you're presented with the facts, there is a good chance you will come to good conclusions. Unfortunately, many of these institutions, including institutions of higher ed, there's been a transformation of teaching propaganda rather than scholarship. And so the degradation of the academy, I mean, the group that I head, Scholars for Peace in the Middle East, came about now 22 years ago as a result of the boycott movement to mobilize faculty left, right, and center who were, you know, again, the impetus was the boycotts at British universities. And then, you know, Durban, you know, was also a big, you know, crescendo in all of this. And what happened was that people started to, individuals were getting boycotted based on their institutions and their affiliations. And the immediate judgment call, no matter what kind of Zionist you were, left, right, or center, was you're Jewish, you're a Zionist, you're a racist. So we need to boycott you. And so that binary perspective has led to not only a cottage industry where you have faculty and now you have students who are being taught based on this echo chamber. And we need to do a much better job. I always say this tongue in cheek. We may have bought the buildings. The opposition bought the education. From a cost-benefit analysis, they've done a much better job in teaching all of this. So by the time you get to 10-7 and you see what we saw now with the hearings on Capitol Hill, the only thing that was surprising about that, for example, was, you know, obviously it spotlighted the rot in the academy, but it really highlighted everything we knew was happening and finally was on full display for the world to see the stupidity, the ignorance that we've observed, that people can't call anti-Semitism for what it is.
Yep, yeah. And again, I mean, it's been a long time, you know, since I've had any connection with college campuses. But I mean, what I've heard from other people is that if their students are taking courses in the Middle East, I mean, somebody was saying to me, I cannot believe that there is not significant Arab money coming in that has had a profound impact on what is taught about the Middle East. Like, look, I don't know, but it certainly is possible. I mean, is there evidence that one of the reasons that so much of what is being taught, again, at the elite universities is influenced by Arab money, or is that just normal Jewish paranoia?
No, it's not paranoia, actually. I mean, you know, I've been looking and studying this for years, for decades.
I know you have. That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah. You know, there's been a pouring of Arab money into our institution since the 1960s. And, you know, in the tone of billions and billions of dollars, not to mention Qatari money that has been buying K through 12 institutions. And the Qataris have been complacent with the events of 10/7. But what you saw is a very, you know, to my earlier point, that they did buy the institutions with the clear understanding that if one buys the chairs of departments, one buys the politics and the narrative in which these topics are being taught.
And the culture.
I mean, and it was done in a very kind of understated way. I mean, one of the first places that was kind of taken over was the King Fahad Center at the University of Arkansas. Nobody paid attention to what was going on there. And then slowly but surely, you have an entire industry of Middle East studies that has been basically pro-Arab, Palestinian, and pro-BDS. I mean, so the Middle East Studies Association, which is the number one organization for groups supporting in the field of Middle East studies, is basically now fully endorsed the BDS movement. To my mind, they're no longer a scholarly organization, they're advocacy. And so,
how are people like you treated by your academic colleagues? I mean, do they look at you just as a Zionist propagandist or as somebody with legitimate academic credentials? I mean, look, one of the things that I always liked about talking to you is you're not an ideologue. You know, right. you really look upon these things as certainly somebody who is very, very supportive of Israel, but as a trained academic.
Right. I mean, I think that we have been ostracized. I mean, that's been part of the reasons why the two groups that I had, you know, the Association of Middle East Studies in Africa, which was founded by Bernard Lewis and Fouad Ajami, and the late giants, the people that I followed and studied with. And then you have people like an SPME, which, again, people felt isolated. There was a need to create a community because they're feeling ostracized and isolated. I mean, I remember, I haven't been a member of Mesa for years, but, there were, you know, after 9/11, the president of Mesa goes on stage and basically mocks the study of terrorism, calling everybody who studied terrorism terrorologists and warmongers. And so there was a need to basically deflect, ignore. Their entire read of the Middle East has been flawed. And as a result of that, that has trickled down into the academy. And that's exactly what these students are hearing and listening to. And that's the byproduct of this historical foundation that has been built on smokes and mirrors.
And it fits into the desire of young people to be humanitarians. So yeah. It is not only how they're being influenced intellectually, but politically, that, you know, if you're a mensch, you have to care about the suffering of the Palestinian people. And
right. The insidious part about all of this, that for a region that is so rich in culture, politically, theologically, historically, has been relegated to a black and white binary conversation about victimhood, which is exactly what you see on college campuses. That's part of the what is known as the DEI narrative on American college campuses, diversity, equity, and inclusion, where the Israelis can do no right and the Palestinians can do no wrong. And so that is disingenuous. And I think that's what we need to break those molds.
We're almost out of time. I want to ask you something you can answer on one foot. And if BB called you up, what would you advise? He said, you know, Asaf, you know, well, let's schmooze a little bit. What do you think you ought to be doing?
Look, I don't want to be in Bibi's shoes. And, you know, he has a tough job to do. I think that Netanyahu is in a conundrum. I mean, and I think that
he is in one or both.
I think it's both. I mean, I think there has to be, you know, a real clear observation of a day of reckoning of what has taken place in Israel. I do think that, interestingly enough, I mean, ironically, Netanyahu is probably the most liberal person is in his own cabinet, given the configuration.
Yeah, I said that to somebody the other day. So you got to be kidding. I said, no, you should see who's in the cabinet.
you should really see what's there. But I think there has to be an introspective look at where Israel is going. I think it's a very serious matter. But I do think that 10-7 did not happen in a vacuum. This took years to plan, and there, you know, and I was talking early on after when the war began to an old intel colleague, a former general, who basically said to me, "Look, you know, he was a young intel officer at Yom Kippur, you know, and here, you know, and they said the difference was at Yom Kippur we misread the intel. Here we were caught blindsided." And he's already retired. And so somebody's going to have to like answer to all of these questions. And but I know the reality now is for Israelis, every day is 10-7. And so there needs to be a sense of restoring of security, confidence. Okay. The social contract has been broken between Israelis and their leadership. And that has to be restored. And I don't have a good answer to that, but it's going to take time.
You know what? I mean, I have said to people that the government, not only Bibi, owes to the people of Israel an explanation of how this was allowed to happen. Because, I mean, more and more we read about the intelligence, whether it was, you know, people who were working at, I mean, I know somebody whose son said that he saw documents weeks ago that indicated military training noises. They said military parades. He said, "What the hell did they think they were doing over there? What, you know, why do you hear all this equipment? What was going on?" And they said it was ignored, and that ranking officers were saying, you know, there's a problem brewing, and somebody decided not to deal with it. As a matter of fact, the person I was talking to said he saw it as arrogance on the part of people who were making these decisions. Said, "Don't worry, let them attack. We'll be able to take care of it." And
I mean, I see that phenomenon. Israel got kind of addicted or obsessed with the need for quiet. And as a result of that, they ignored all the major problems. I mean, there is declassified documents from colleagues of mine who I know and speak to, where they were also warning Sharon that this engagement from Gaza was not going to be defensible. And that was before it was, they didn't go into the extent of a 10-7, but there were seeds of seeing actual problems by not leaving any kind of military presence, because we lost human intel as a result of all of this. And the evidence that was there that allowed this to happen, today we have blueprints. We have the videos of evidence of how long this took to plan, all with the imprimatur, by the way, of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You know what? We are almost up. Is there any wisdom you would like other than thank you so much. You know, I'm really glad I did this, because, as I said, I always like talking to you, because, you know, you're a good analyst, and you're not an ideologue, Asaf, and I think sometimes our ideology stands in the way of our making good decisions.
I appreciate your kind words.
I would love to have you back sometime in the future, hopefully where we could celebrate that we are hearing good news from Eretz Yisrael. You know what? The Jewish people deserve it. So
I look forward to that, and, you know, I appreciate the opportunity, Bert.
All right. And say hi at home, please.
I will.